welcome to the latest episode of Cover to Cover. I'm Joanne Joseph. Lovely to be with you as always. Now, recently the inaugural Artfluence Festival was held in Durban, focusing on the Constitution, arts and democracy. The festival afforded my colleague, Eusebius Mackayser, and I the opportunity to interview a number of authors. One of them was the author of The Lie of 1652, Patrick Tariq Mellett. His book was published a few months ago, and it set out to debunk historical myths about the landing of the Dutch colonizers in our country in the 17th century and to exhume long-buried truths about the politics of that time. I had a fascinating conversation with Patrick on how he went about reconstructing this period in history and what he hopes to achieve with it.
A lot of our historical information has contradictions in it that jump out, but we don't know what to do with those contradictions. So let me just give you an example. We're told that Jan van der Beek came here in 1652 and that this was more or less really the first time that the Europeans and the indigenous people were meeting. Then I discover through maritime history, because I was, I had a job in the maritime arena, and I find that there's like over 1,071 ships that come to Cape Town before Jan van der Beek, and it involves 120,000 people. And with such a vast traffic, there has to have been impact both ways on the indigenous people and on the Europeans. Also, the European ships were often manned by African sailors, Arab sailors, Indian sailors, and so on. So that immediately said to me, wow, there's a different angle to this whole history. And if I apply it to everything, right back to this notion of that there was this empty land that the Europeans came to, and one set of questions after the next opened up a whole new world. And I had to share it. the book, is really my bubbling over. And as I say in the book, don't necessarily take what I'm saying as this is now the new gospel. What it is someone sharing their journey of exploration around restorative memory with others and saying, please go on the journey yourself. You may even find out much more than I've found out. But here's what I've been finding. And really, it opens a whole lot of new questions. And this is what it's all about. The journey is not about sort of saying, oh, now we've got the new and it's a box and we'll sit it on a pedestal. It's about using the new to open up new news.
Yes,
And that's the journey that I'm wishing to share with people.
Well, Patrick, that intrigues me because your ideas around what we've simply taken for granted for so long and accepted as de facto information about our past clearly needs to be re-engaged. We clearly need to go back to the archives. The archives perhaps need to be rewritten and revised themselves. How much of that work, that revisionism from a historical point of view, needs to be done in order for us to process our past as Africans?
I believe it's essential, and this is the challenge that I put out to you, to young Black researchers particularly. For instance, if we just again take this issue of the shipping, I found that there's a huge database in the Netherlands of all the ship's logs for that entire period, 1600 till 1800, and only a portion of those logs have been taken to the next level. Now, in those logs, there may well be, written record of sailors' interactions with indigenous people. It's crying out for a young Black researcher to go there. And I say young Black researcher because you need to look at this with different eyes. The European gaze has been there and we've had it, ad infinitum. We do need to look with different eyes at things and experience. Your experience, the Black experience, is the different eye that's needed. So I would like to see people going to that Huygens archive and basically going through those ship logs. Only a portion of it has been done in terms of the ships that actually stopped at the Cape. Some of them have still got to be discovered through the logs, whether they stopped or not. But I'm more interested in, I know, for instance, from history, it tells us that at least 8 Black South Africans before Jan van der Beek traveled abroad to London, to Java, and so on. We only have 2 fragmented accounts of those people, and there may well have been more people. The only way we're going to know this is if researchers can go to these materials and begin to look for this. The European is not going to go and look for it because there's no interest in that. When we're looking at Black history, we've got to have Black eyes looking at it. People may say that that's subjective. Well, isn't European eyes subjective too? So my challenge is for young Black people to get involved in the archaeology of South Africa, to get involved in the social history research, and to break new ground. Because what we're looking for is the silent Black voice. Whether that silent Black voice talks to us through ceramics that have been left and bones that have been left, whether it talks to us through genetics, whether it talks to us through linguistics, whether it talks to us through hardcore research of European shipping records or whatever, we have to do that. And it's an exciting world because it's clearly got information. The fact that I found just this little bit, you know, and you might find that volume quite thick in that, but really it's a little bit. Mm-hmm. There must be so much more. My problem is our universities are not exciting young people to do this. It's almost like we send our youngsters to these very colonially impregnated universities and they get this canned education. Now, we all know that innovation and education comes from daring to do something wrong rather than to do it right. So, you know, scientists find things because they dare to walk outside of the circle. And our universities are teaching people to regurgitate rather than to go and create and find new information. The whole style of, you know, because I've done my master's and I know it's kind of panel beats you into an approach which is based on you just quoting all the established resources. But what you want is people coming up with new information saying, I went to this that hasn't been touched before and this is what I have found. Yes, those guys said this and this and this about it, but I'm now saying that should we not have a new hypothesis? Should we not think differently? I would like our institutions to excite young people. My book is aimed at exciting young people to disrupt. Now, disrupt doesn't mean going around burning tires and breaking shop windows. And that. Disrupt essentially is dealing with the colonization of the mind. Whether we like it or not, we have been colonized in our heads. That's the big frontier that we have got to break down. And so what I'm saying is I want to excite young people to ask questions, to disrupt, and to come up with new information, because we will always remain trapped in colonialism if our minds are captured by colonialism.
Yeah. Patrick, let me ask you a final question, because you talk about documenting, recreating the archive. And surely one great example of that is the Khamisa Museum, which launched last month. Can you give me a sense very briefly of exactly what you've brought together, all the threads that you've pulled together in this museum?
Yes, the museum idea was inspired by the late stalwart Reg September, who in many ways people may not know a lot about him, but he was kind of like the Nelson Mandela of the Cape Flats, if I could put it that way, and one of my mentors. And he basically said to me, look here, you know, we need to go into that colonial space, the Castle of Good Hope. Something like 50,000 of our school children go there on annual pilgrimages with their teachers every year. And all they see is this colonial building and colonial artifacts and so on. And so we need to tell the story that of the people, of the indigenous people, of the enslaved people from Africa and Asia, who had everything to, their entire lives were dominated by this castle over a long period. So what we said was, we need something tangible, you know, a book. Most books, like most theses and so on, sit on bookshelves and they get dusty. They don't filter down to the people. So how do we bring this knowledge to a school child from the Cape Flats, from a sub-economic home, from abject poverty? How do we bring this history to mean something to those children? Now, the first thing is that the child wants to see themselves. They want to see people who look like them, and hear the stories of those people. They want to know how people who were poor like them managed to become somebody who was a creative, who was a contributor to our society. So the museum encapsulates a whole range of things. It starts off with that question, who do you think you are? And it then moves from who do you think you are to how apartheid and colonialism classified us. And then we look at that history of classification, and we come through to what we call the seven tributaries. The Camisa River, and the river is used as a metaphor. The Camisa River still flows through Cape Town today. It once flowed through Cape Town openly, but it's now tunneled underneath the city. And in a sense, it's a metaphor for what's happened to us and our history. The history has a lot to do with people who are classified as colored, but it's got to do with everybody in South Africa as well, because we don't have these bubbles, even although we've been made into a bubble society. So it takes seven tributaries and then looks at our over 195 roots of origin of people who had been classified colored, roots of origin in Africa and in Asia to a large degree, and small element of European as well. And we unpack that. But we unpack it by showing personalities, the stories. So under each tributary, we'll take five or six individuals who fall under that tributary and tell you that personality's story. So it ranges from indigenous Africans right through in the seventh category to the continuing migrants of color. And in between, you've got African and Asian enslaved peoples. You have the free black population, the nonconformist Europeans, the Maroons and Oorlam, exiles and refugees, and then finally the sailors and indentures and migrants of color. And we take this whole thing. How many South Africans know that Australian Aborigines were brought out during the Boer War as trekkers, and the Australians refused to accept them back, and they're part of our ancestry? So we go into 195 of these stories, and then we end off the museum by introducing people on how to do your family tree, how to go about doing your DNA, and what that tells you. And then the grand finale is, here is a wall of recognition over where we have a few hundred pictures and names of people, the first veterinarian, a black man trained in Scotland, and so on, a nuclear physicist and et cetera, et cetera. So by the time this kid leaves this museum, they've come out from a space which says, I don't know who I am, to a space which says, wow, I am born of a people who rose above adversity. All of these sorts of adversities, and they didn't just rise up, they rose up triumphantly over all of this. So it's a practical way. It's a tangible, it's taking the intangible and making it tangible. So often we have sites. There's a site known as Clifton Beach, which we call Masbikar Beach, because a slave ship sank literally meters away from this beach where, the rich and famous go and lay in the sun and all of that. And 200 enslaved people drowned there. 300 that survived were sold on that beach. But there's no marker at the beach to say what this important site was all about. So what I do is I am trying to change our physical environment to recognize what is hidden. And it's about making things intangible, tangible. Again, we get back to where I started from. Restorative memory is absolutely vital to restorative justice. And if I just give you a little pen picture of practically what that can mean. District 6. District 6 had over 60,000 people living there that were forcibly removed. Now we're in the new era, and people are looking for restorative justice. So to get restorative justice, you've got to produce a title deed for a piece of land in District 6 to be able to have restorative justice. So hence, there's only about 930 claimants. Now, 60,000 people lost their homes, lost their world, lost their cultural habitat. But there's no restorative justice because the restorative memory that's being used is title deeds. So this is why it is so important to be able to remember the past so that it can inform the decisions of the present to transform. And that isn't fully understood in South Africa. You know, the subtitle of my book is, you know, A Decolonized History of Land. So I've ended off, you know, this answer by giving an example, just one small sliver of an example about a land issue that is clouded by legalese rather than restorative memory. And that's why this is all so important. If we don't have this, we simply will become a neo-colony where all of the same that has existed over the last 400 years continues, but we have, you know, slight structural changes. What we really want is the kind of change that changes people's lives. And in Cape Town here, so many families, one in seven families lives in an informal settlement or lives as a backyard dweller. People would do not have their homes. You know, this whole thing of people having no hope, having no abode, having no means for a sustainable livelihood, this all has a historical background. And until we face up to that historical background, we won't find and we won't be urgent in trying to find solutions to the present problems.
That was my conversation with Patrick Tariq Mellett, the author of The Lie of 1652. Very distinctive cover. Look out for that on the shelves. Now, Eusebius spends a fair amount of time exploring texts that link strongly to this idea of decolonization, building new identities, writing for a very different present and future that help us break with the pain of the past, or at least enable us to process it. So Eusebius is with me now. Eusebius, what is on your just read or to be read list right now?
Oh, there's so many, but by the first thing I've got to say is I love how you say I spend a lot of time reading texts as you sit with a library of books in front of you.
You should see the one next to my bed.
There's a lot of things I'm reading currently, and I'm sure a lot of them will surface on our show over the next couple of weeks. For example, the book that Tony Leon has just wrote about his views on a number of contemporary South African issues and historical issues. That's one book. And then there's some books not available in South Africa that I'm reading. Musa Okwongwa, who is an absolutely brilliant British writer of Ugandan descent based in Berlin. And so there's a lot more that I read that's not even on the show for that matter. But I think some of the books you and I will discuss are books that I've read a while back. I've returned to some of them because they link very nicely with that conversation you had with Patrick.
Yeah. Now, I love what Patrick has done with this book because he's toying very much with the idea of going back to the archives, the existing archives, and hypothesizing about them in entirely new ways. This is one book that actually does it pretty well, I think, Rogues Gallery. It's by Matthew Blackman and Nick Doll, and they call it An Irreverent History of Corruption in South Africa, from the VOC to the ANC. But essentially, they're dispelling this myth that corruption began post-democracy with the ANC government in power. And they go back, I mean, some of the historical figures that they feature here include people like Cecil John Rhodes, Charles Somerset, Paul Kruger, some very interesting historical figures over whose legacies we glossed during our apartheid education.
I think it's very important, Joanne. That's why I've chosen to reference a book that some of the viewers of Cover to Cover would have seen me interviewing the author of, and this is The Trial of Cecil John Rhodes. It's a novella, but it's a novella that is really the equivalent of historical fiction. It's a very serious book, even though it is a novella and there's lots of humor in it. And the reason why it's important is that it inscribes into the public space precisely what you've just referenced, i.e. the criticality of understanding that even as we rightly critique those who are now eating at the trough, and I'll get to another text in a second that speaks to that, At the same time, we need to take a long view of history. And the truth of the matter is that when you have someone like Cecil John Rhodes, who, by the way, interesting fun fact, if it came out of the pub, is the historical figure that is the most, what is the right verb, who has the most number of iconography in Southern Africa in his name, that the historical record has got to be set right. Yeah. And this book does exactly that.
I just love, and I haven't got to it yet, but I love the idea that Adeke Adebajo has approached this book with, right? We've got dozens of textbooks on the shelf about Cecil John Rhodes. We've got that history being revised as we speak. But the idea of setting up that character with four postmodern or modern day characters and putting the 19th century sensibilities to the test is for me it's a hugely stunning. Interesting approach.
It's absolutely stunning, and what it speaks to, for especially for you as a literary nerd from a technique point of view, is that the conversation we're having and the one that you had with Patrick doesn't have to be a dreary one. Reading this book is actually reading pleasure. So it's not just about collating facts and setting the historical record straight. This is actually a book that is eminently readable and great fun.
Yeah. Now, I'm looking at this one as well, okay, because some of the history that Patrick spoke about in his interview has actually not really been uncovered yet. This is called Hitler's Spies, and it's written by Erfurt Kleinhans. It's about secret agents and the intelligence war in South Africa. It takes us back to a very interesting period, the story of the intelligence war in South Africa during the Second World War, and it's described as one of suspense, drama, and dogged persistence, talking about when the Union of South Africa entered the war on Britain's side, and the German government secretly reached out to political opposition and to the leadership of the anti-war movement at the time. And essentially, this is about spy networks in South Africa that existed during the Second World War.
That is so prescient, because one of the things we're dealing with in South Africa right now, which is not sufficiently lifted to the surface by the commentariat, but it's critical to what's wrong with our democracy, is the securitization of our politics and the role that spies and former spy bosses like Mo Sheikh, that I've interviewed for the program, have played is often not well understood, because they are a silo that's independent of the political silo. So it's really interesting that that book exists. I really must pick it up. Very quickly, if you have enough time, there are two other books that I brought with that are really interesting, that intersect with your conversation with Patrick in different ways. The first is The Land is Ours by one of the best lawyers of our generation, Thembeka Mukaitobi. And the reason why I picked this one is not because it completes the historical record from the archives in the way in which Patrick started it, although there's also archival work that Thembeka did, but then he talks here about the work of black jurists at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, and it gives you a sense of legal jurisprudence by black folk beginning to fight back against colonialism, which I think is also very important. And I like drawing connections, Joanne, between history and today, which is why I really like that Hitler Spy book, and I'm going to pick it up and buy it. This book, It's Our Turn to Eat, most people know it. It's a classic title, and it alludes to what we're seeing playing out at the Zondo Commission currently, which is how so many of the liberation era heroes have turned out to be neo-colonialists who are now eating at the trough.
You know, that's so interesting, also because Thembeka Mukaitobi is taking it forward with his book Land Matters as well, which I think is something else to look out for. But the last point you made with It's Our Turn to Eat by Michaela Rong also ties in very nicely with this latest book, Nation on the Couch. And I think it's interesting because it's subtitled Inside South Africa's Mind.
I saw it, yeah.
You also wonder, I mean, what is that about? And you've got really well-known writers like Richard Pittas who've commented on this book. But essentially, what they're doing here is looking at our country currently through the lens of psychoanalysis.
Yes.
You know, and the question arises, can you give a country that personality, that sort of conscience?
You and me both,
analyze it on a couch. Well, that is what this writer is doing, Wabi Long, clinical psychologist and associate professor in the Department of Psychology at UCT. So that should be an interesting one indeed. And this one I picked up just out of interest. This is the great thing about just walking through a bookshop, Yubi, which is a little different to buying online, is that you just, you know, you're grabbed by intriguing covers and so forth. And this book, Searching for Sarah by Dominic Malherbe, looks like a really interesting one to me for all sorts of reasons. I love mystery stories, and when they're tied in with historical fiction or literary history, I find it even more interesting. So this is a story of the Afrikaans literary icon, C.J. Langenhoven, who died suddenly at the age of 58. And all of a sudden, the family discovered that a young Jewish woman, Sarah, Vera Eva Goldblatt had become the executrix of his literary legacy.
Oh, wow.
And no one could make the connection at first, but there appeared to be quite an intense and interesting relationship there. And that is what this uncovers. It goes back to original letters, archival research and so forth, and family memories, memories, and it's written much as a sort of biography.
Where are you going to get time from to go through all these books?
I have
in
no
between
idea.
Being mom and the present lover?
Well, I think I might have to renege on one of those roles in the next few weeks to get through all of these. So lots to look forward to that's coming out in the next few weeks. Keep visiting the bookstores. Keep having a browse. You will be so drawn to so many books on the shelves. It really takes discipline not to pick them all up. Thank you, Eusebio, so much for sharing those thoughts with me on what you've been reading. I hope you enjoyed the show today. Remember, all the books we've spoken about can also be ordered online at www.exclusivebooks.co.za, or, as I said, go into the stores, better yet, to find them. Eusebius will be back with you in 2 weeks for the next episode of Cover to Cover. Take care. Goodbye.